Kristen was born in El Paso, Texas, raised by two actor parents. By day, she helps theater and dance students graduate from college. And in the evenings, she can be found in the dark theater space creating complex characters. Please welcome Kristen Monson.
Thanks for setting me up like that, Devin. That was awesome. Hopefully your mouth won't be too far off your jaw. Thank you all. I'm usually storytelling on the stage, and so I can hide behind a costume or a character, so this is a really difficult thing for someone who is an actor to be themselves in front of a group of people. So my storytelling may be, I don't know, a little wackadoodle tonight, because this is a different process. My father was also a storyteller, but he told stories through film. He was a filmmaker. And as we say in the South, as in Texas, his stories were probably not fit for, you know, company is what we used to say, a story not fit for company to hear. So let's flash back to when I learned about him for the first time. So 1982, I was with my father for the summer in North Hollywood, California, and I split my time in the summers between my mom and dad, my mom was in Texas, and so I'm a teenager, they're gone, I'm watching late night television, and does anyone remember Elvira, Mistress of the Dark? And she hosted, you know, like the horror genre late at night, and she had like the big bouffant and like the cut down to her naval dress. So I'm watching that. I watched it every night, and then she announced the next film would be Legacy of Blood, directed and written by Carl Monson. Like, that there can't be more than one Carl Monson, can there? My dad made commercials, and he made Lauren Green's Last of the Wild, very wholesome entertainment, right? I was even in one of his commercials when I was a little girl. I said, I like the one on the left. It was brilliant. And so I was like, well, this is going to be great. So I watched Legacy of Blood. Loosely, the plot is a group of family members meets in a haunted or maybe not haunted mansion in the middle of a dark and stormy night to hear the reading of a will. And if they can make it through the night without being murdered, they will get the will's contents. Okay. Sounds a little bit like Agatha Christie, except for there's all these gruesome murders that happen, right? So a man's head is decapitated and served on a platter, and one man ends up in a piranha tank because everybody has a piranha tank in their mansion. And one guy like gets locked in a room with killer bees, and he gets stung all over the place and dies this evil, awful death. And it was just hilarious. It was horrible. It was a horrible, horrible movie. I went on Rotten Tomatoes, actually, in preparation for this, and there are people that watch these movies. I mean, they have way too much time on their hands. And you can see it on YouTube tonight. You can go home and watch it. He said, this movie is like watching 9 actors in search of a career. It really was. But Rotten Tomatoes gives it a 7%. So there are 7% of the people out there who actually enjoyed this film. So I'm sitting there thinking, I don't know my father at all. You know, I'm like 13. I've only spent a little bit of time with him because they were divorced when I was 3. So like, I don't know him at all. I need to get to know him better. So let's flash back even further. So my father didn't really have a father. He was born and didn't even know who his father was. And his mother died when he was very young. So he was raised in California by relatives. And so as soon as he could, he got out, went to the Navy, was in the Navy, did his duty. And, you know, the logical next step after the Navy is he decided to be an actor. So he went to the Pasadena Playhouse, which at the time in the 1950s was called the Star Factory. So big stars like Dustin Hoffman went there with him, and Gene Hackman, and Rue McClanahan. Younger people don't know who any of those people are, but the rest of you might. And so he went there, and he was going to be a serious actor. He met my mother, Carol Shelton, at the time, and they got married. And their friends said they were both so beautiful, they were surprised they did anything except for stare at each other all day long. And they thought they were very vain, and they probably were. They got married, and my mother was an actress. They opened a theater together. And eventually, they had my brother, and then they had me, and in 1969, and then 1973, they were divorced. So that's what, I mean, I didn't even know my father. And there are lots of reasons why they probably got divorced. He didn't ever have a steady job. He couldn't hold a penny into his name. He spent all his money. He had affairs with his leading ladies in movies. But my mom says the final straw was one day she came home from work and she went to the backyard and there were like 50 strangers having a party in her backyard in her pool, and there was a horse tied to the tree. And she was like, what is that horse and why is it tied to the tree in my backyard? And he said, well, I had to sell the family car because I'm making a movie and I need a horse. And she was like, that's it. That's the final straw. So she took us back to Texas and said, this is ridiculous. But what I didn't know at the time and what she didn't tell me was, before all of that and during my childhood, he was making a bunch of other films. And the films he was making fall into a subgenre called sexploitation films, okay? So some of you are nodding your head. So these are late 60s, early 70s films that were gratuitous violence, but peppered in with a bunch of, like, not even needed nudity for no reason. So combine a bunch of silly violence with sex. So let me just give you some examples. So one of his earlier films was called The Acid Eaters, which is about a group of coworkers who attend a 50-foot tower of LSD every Friday and congregate there, and sex ensues. Gratuitous sex. We're not talking about hardcore stuff. This is like 70s. Like, we would consider it like NC-17R. But back then, it was like pretty scandalous, right? So secondly, there was Booby Trap, which my father actually wrote, directed, and starred in, about a crazed veteran who gets in an RV because he wants to blow up a hippie concert with dynamite. And along the way in the RV, sex ensues. And then the last one, Please Don't Eat My Mother. I know, right? This is really a familiar tale about a mild-mannered shop owner who gets a plant that can talk. What story is that? Little Shop of Horrors. Except this mild-mannered man is actually a voyeur. So he likes to, like, watch people, you know, going at it, and the plant will then eat them after he watches them. Okay, so you're laughing, and these are hysterically funny. My mother did not think they were so hysterically funny. So that's one of the reasons why she got us away. So it wasn't really until I was a teenager that I was allowed to go see my father. So she kept us way far away from him. But I thought it was great. I didn't have any rules. I didn't have to follow any rules. I never got punished for anything. When I was with him, I could take the bus all over Los Angeles when I was 13, cut my hair all off, dye it purple. I could do anything I wanted. So he was more of like this funny uncle that I had. You know, he would tell us jokes. He would sing opera really badly. He always either had tons of money, like he'd be driving a Porsche or a Cadillac, or he had no money, right? He'd have a scooter. I'm surprised he didn't get a horse, you know, to like his only means of transportation. So one summer I was there, and the thing about this part of the story is, this part of the story I haven't really told many people in my whole life. So it's very weird for me to tell a whole group of people, but actually I think it's going to be easier. So not even my children know this part of the story. So one time I was visiting him, and I went into his room when he wasn't there, and there was a scale just sitting on the dresser, and there was some white powder kind of spattered around. And I'm thinking, it's the 80s, right? So everyone knows about cocaine, and I think, there's cocaine in my dad's bedroom, right? And not only that, there's like little packages like with cocaine in them. And it just dawns on me, my dad is a drug dealer. Like, he's dealing drugs. And then I start thinking, oh, all those limousines that pull up in front of the house, and then the people come in and he talks to them. I thought he just had a bunch of really great friends, you know? And they'd say like, oh yeah, like this famous person's in the limo, and they talk and go into my dad's room. And I just thought that was normal. And then I realized, wow, this is not safe. Like, this is really, I was really angry because I was like a part of like Students Against Drunk Driving, and I was very like, you know, you have to be responsible when you drink and drive. And here my dad is dealing drugs out of the house like 10 feet away from where I am. So I didn't tell my mom, I didn't tell anybody, because I really kind of wanted to come back to California and experience this, like, you know, freedom. But that same visit, I found a bunch of money in his glove compartment. I was so angry. I took a bunch of it, like $300. and I'm going to show him. And I went to the Galleria with my friends, and I bought all these Adamant posters and Billy, you know, all these David Bowie pins and all these clothes that were like new wave punk clothing. And I came home, and he didn't even notice. He didn't even notice that money was gone. So that tells you it was just, he wasn't even aware of me even being there. So it was another TV episode. Flash forward to my senior year in high school. I'm watching TV back in Texas. I'm watching Entertainment Tonight, back when people actually got their entertainment news from the television. And Mary Hart comes on with her beautiful legs, and she says, "Today in Hollywood, director, writer Carl Monson was shot in his home during a drug raid." And I'm thinking, here's the second time I'm watching television learning about my father, you know, that something happening to him that I have no connection to. So sure enough, I finally got a hold of my stepmother, and she said, "Yeah, your dad was asleep on his good ear because he was in a car accident and he lost hearing in one ear, so he was asleep. He thought someone was breaking in the house when he heard them knocking, so he got a gun out and shot it into the air, and then they shot him." That's the part where you're supposed to laugh. I laugh at it, but I mean, you guys are probably not laughing, but I think it's funny because he was always going, "What? I can't hear you." And that was really to his detriment. So he didn't die. He was just shot, and he was arrested. And I actually got to talk to him, and he said, "You know, I know I was doing what I was doing was wrong, but I, you know, I don't think I could handle life in prison. I just don't think I could do that. I would not be able to do that." Understandably, right? So while he was out, you know, kind of waiting for trial, and we're talking, he had a heart attack. And so then kind of his health went downhill from then. And I visited him one last time, December, after my senior year, my freshman year in college. And it was the first time I actually had an adult conversation with him. You know, like, we were talking about old times in Los Angeles. We were at the train station. He was telling me what Hollywood was like in the 1950s and 60s. And it seemed so innocent and happy with my mom. And I got on the train, and I went back to Texas. And that year, before the trial, he had a massive heart attack and he died. I was 19, he was 55. So I was sad, of course, but again, I don't know what I was grieving for. I didn't really know him anyway. I just knew him as this funny uncle. So when we went out to the funeral, he was being buried in the Veterans Cemetery. And he was not a religious man, he was an atheist. They said, "What kind of music would you like played on the organ? You know, like, we need to have some music while people are filing in." And by people, I mean like cameramen, drag queens, transvestites, you know, just the funniest group of people. Like, what do these people have in common, right? So my stepmother and I said, "Well, he really liked Billy Joel, like anything Piano Man, Billy Joel music, or maybe Fleetwood Mac, or, you know, Journey, something like that, modern contemporary music." "Yeah, yeah, no problem." So we're sitting in the pew, everyone's very solemn and quiet, and I know you probably couldn't hear it, but Devin played it right before I came on. We're sitting there, and all of a sudden we hear, "Billy Joe McAllister jumped off the Tallahassee Bridge. Ode to Billy Joe." And we just started laughing. Like, it was as if my dad was playing the joke on everybody, because we were like screaming, "Billy Joel!" You know? Not "Ode to Billy Joe" about a guy committing suicide. That's not what you play at a memorial. Yeah. So I can really laugh about it now, and I'm glad you guys are laughing about it. But like I said, I didn't learn a lot from him. I did learn to be a storyteller because of him. And I was really ashamed of his story for a really long time. And like I said, I haven't even told a lot of people the whole story about my father. So thank you for giving me the opportunity to do that in a way that I felt safe. And I hope that he's up there listening to Billy Joel and listening to my story. Thank you.